everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk and Tristan Mills. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
So this week's session is on data retention. It was a very busy session and there was a lot going on in the chat. So we've had a lot of contributions, a lot of debate. It's really interesting one that we picked apart. But there were some issues with the recording, so we missed out some of the news pieces. So it's probably worth just reiterating those for your benefit now. So Joe and Tristan, I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the bits I saw in the news this week was Amazon agreeing to a permanent injunction and $25 million civil penalty to settle alleged children's privacy violations related to its Alexa voice assistant. The US Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission have announced that a complaint filed in the US District Court for the Western District of Washington alleges Amazon retained children's voice recordings indefinitely and engaged in unfair privacy practices regarding geolocation information and voice recordings. Among requirements of the order, Amazon must identify and delete inactive child profiles.
Thank you. And Tristan.
Another news story is that the Department of Health and Human Services and the Federal Trade Commission have issued a joint letter to 130 companies regarding their online data collection processes. The letter was sent to companies that use online tracking technologies that disclose sensitive personal health information to third parties, potentially in the violation of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act and the Federal Trade Commission Health Breach Notification Rule. The letter emphasizes that the use of certain tracking technologies in ways that are unavoidable and unknowable to the user may constitute and impermissible disclosure of information. The letter also clarifies that both agencies are closely watching developments in this new area, and we discussed about whether this could also be in breach of PECA and the UK GDPR as well, and wondering what the lawful basis will be for this.
Thank you for that. I'll take the next one. So the European Data Protection Board has adopted an information note on data transfers under the EU-US Data Privacy Framework. So EDPB Chair Anuta Loos said that the note explains individuals' rights and organisations' obligations. The European Data Protection Board will continue to pay special attention to the correct implementation of this new instrument, and they look forward to contributing to the first review of the framework next year, she said. So the European Data Protection Board has also adopted a statement on the first review of the EU's adequacy decision with Japan. So, Joe, you had a couple of things to say about that in the session, didn't you?
I did, yes, because I've been doing a blog on the EU-US data privacy framework for Miles to post on our socials, and I did a little bit of digging through the framework, and it's fairly long and fairly difficult to read, I'm not going to lie. I was having a look at the principles because, Jasmine, you highlighted the principles on a session 2 weeks ago from section 2, I think it was, or clause 2 of the framework. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing some digging, I actually discovered that there's principles in Annex 1 as well. And it's not particularly clear as to whether which ones are the principles that organizations must rely on. I don't know if it's the ones that are at the top of the framework or the ones that are in the annex, or if it's both. So it's really quite difficult to, to read and to understand and then to apply that. So I'm quite glad I'm not a US organization having to demonstrate my compliance mm-hmm. with this, because I don't know where I begin. I don't know if you two have read it, but it's a real mess. It's worse than the Data Protection Act, in my opinion.
Oh, well, that's a statement. I read, the first, 30 pages of the framework before that session, which, because it had come out the day before, I believe, but I do wonder, is there no cross reference between the principles in the annex and section 2?
There is things in the principles at the top where it's like, see annex 1, for example, but I don't know. It's, and that's, maybe that's just me just being me, or I don't know, but I couldn't wrap my head around it. Just sat here thinking about it. It's making me off at the mouth.
So anyway, moving on. So the Norwegian Supervisory Authority has ordered Meta to temporarily cease the processing of personal data of data subjects in Norway for the purpose of targeting ads when relying on either contractual necessity as a legal basis or legitimate interests. The order only covers targeted advertising based on observed behaviour. Accordingly, it does not preclude Meta from processing personal data for advertising purposes, nor does it limit advertising or the targeting of ads based on information that the data subject has provided through their Facebook profile or if they provided their consent. So the Meta saga continues. And then I think that final news piece might have actually been caught on the session. So it's simply that Farage complains to the ICO that NatWest shared his data with the BBC. So I may as well go into that one just in case. But Nigel Farage has accused NatWest of sharing his personal data and financial data with the BBC. He has also complained that the ICO, sorry, to the ICO, and his lawyers have written a letter to the ICO claiming that the bank's actions constitute serious data breach and disregard client confidentiality. Having made a start to cuts to discover why his account was being closed, Farage's legal team claimed that the information that was given to the BBC was incomplete and misleading. So there's the news for you. Quickly, just, you know, discussing the main session, we covered quite a lot on retention. I think we covered, you know, basically what it is, how it, you know, the issues that are commonly faced with organizations and how you tackle those. So I think they're big questions that a lot of people face, and they don't really know how to even approach it, because usually with retention, in my opinion, it's a retrospective issue, if that makes sense. So it's something that you come into at a later date, maybe because of the GDPR being 5 years old, that you're trying to resolve. And it's just, you know, it can be difficult to organize your information to then decide how to delete it, when to delete it, and so on. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I kind of refer to retention as a bit of a spaghetti monster within the GDPR. And it was a really fun podcast, though, really, really engaging.
Yeah.
And I completely kind of agree, though, that the challenges that kind of keep occurring and the difficulties that arise around it. We did discuss this in the podcast about using tools and ways to kind of make it more efficient and more effective. And the analogy that I use is to try and create a self-cleaning oven. So, you know, you have really good appetite on managing your data and having a really effective records management. What about yourself, Joe? What do you think of the podcast?
Yeah, no, I echo both your thoughts. I thought it was a great podcast. It's always a lot more enjoyable when people get involved in the chat and unmute and get involved, because, you know, we love it when... you know, we like to say that it's your session as much as it is ours. So, you know, it always helps, and it's always nice to spark a debate. And there was some going on, wasn't there? Especially towards the end, about my real life example of one of our customers placing data into the wrong bin. That's one to listen out for towards the end of the podcast for sure. But I think that's enough being said, and we'll let you jump into the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Seen anything?
Yeah, I have actually, and Steph has just mentioned it in the chat as well, funnily enough. So the Norwegian Supervisory Authority has ordered Meta to temporarily cease the processing of personal data of data subjects in Norway for the purpose of targeted ads when relying on either contractual necessity as a legal basis or legitimate interests. So the order only covers targeted advertising based on observed behaviour. Accordingly, it does not preclude Meta from processing personal data for advertising purposes, nor does it limit advertising on the targeting of ads based on information that the data subjects have provided through their Facebook profile or if they have provided their consent. So thank you for that, Steph. You talked us through these, I guess pixels in a session offline. So it's much appreciated. We are getting there. What else have you seen?
Something I did see in the news, I'm sure everyone's actually seen, it's been a hot topic, and it's, you know, it's been nationwide, really, was the Nigel Farage complaining to the ICO about NatWest sharing his data with the BBC. So Nigel Farage accused NatWest of sharing his personal and financial data with the BBC. He also complained to the ICO, and his lawyers have written a letter to the ICO claiming that the bank's actions constitute a serious data breach and disregard client confidentiality, having made a subject access request to Coutts to discover why his account was being closed. Farage's legal team claimed the information that was given to the BBC was incomplete and misleading.
I think this might be something that could open a lot of floodgates for SARS. I believe that Farage has come out and said that he didn't even know that a subject access request was an actual thing that he could do. And a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, Nadine Dorris did the same for the House of Lords. And I'm now expecting, with the amount of attention this is getting, you know, we're going to see a lot more employees, a lot more data subjects are going to start to do subject access requests. We're starting to see an influx in our SAR Bureau service. So it's definitely exciting times.
Absolutely. Michael, would you like to unmute?
It was going to happen eventually, wasn't it? I mean, the ICO is always trying to get everybody more involved and know more about this. I mean, if I talk to anyone anywhere, you know, when I go to the gym or anything else, no one knows what it is. Even people who have relations to healthcare and other things like that, they just see them as an obstruction in the way. But let's probably see it as it was going to happen. And it's probably good that people do know about it, because you do see a lot of celebrities and other people just trying to get information, so it might actually be good, because it was going to happen eventually anyway. So
yeah, you're quite right.
Thank you, probably not.
Well, we might say thank you, because it will help us.
Yeah.
But you're quite right. When I have conversations with my friends and family about anything relating data, they've got absolutely no idea about any of the rights that they have under UK data protection law. So you know, this might not be such a bad thing, that it's going to bring awareness to people. And so, you know, they can understand that they can access their data and, you know, they can do multiple things with the data, which, you know, ultimately it's all about giving the data subjects the control of their data. And people don't realize that they have that. So, no, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it's only a good thing that people become more aware of their rights.
Mm-hmm. I think the big challenge. Oh, sorry, Jasmine. Just going to say, I think it is. The big challenge now is organizations are going to have to start, or hopefully, I think I should say, organizations will now start looking at like the kind of records management and how they're storing the data, and realistically asking themselves, if someone does do a subject access request, can we fulfill this request within 30 days and whatnot? So it's definitely an interesting aspect. I think it will, hopefully it will raise these kind of concerns and these thoughts and these discussions in organizations.
Absolutely. Steph's put in the chat, not again, Joe, I'm watching the football, tell me about SARS at halftime.
Yeah, I was just about to respond saying it's never during football, Steph. Football always takes priority, I'm afraid.
So we're probably best moving on to the main part of the session. We've got a couple of news pieces, but they can wait till next week, because everybody is here, obviously, for retention. It's a big turnout this week as well. So what is data retention? Where does it originate? Why is it important? Should we start there? Okay. So Article 5.1e of the GDPR specifies that personal data must be kept in a form which permits identification of data subjects for no longer than is necessary for the purposes for which the data, personal data are processed. So personal data may be stored for longer periods insofar as the personal data will be processed solely for archiving purposes in the public interest, scientific or historical research purposes, or statistical purposes in accordance with Article 89.1, subject to implementation of the appropriate technical and organisational measures required by this regulation in order to safeguard the rights and freedoms of the data subject. Storage limitation. So that that is a mouthful. Should we pick that apart a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's probably best to try and strip it back, isn't it, into layman's terms.
Absolutely. So, you know, basically storage limitation or data retention means that you should only retain personal data for as long as is necessary. So as part of that, you need to be able to justify why you're retaining or why you're storing personal data for a specific amount of time, and why you need it for that length of time, essentially. So how do you approach that in practice? What does that mean?
So from my kind of perspective, it's all about taking a kind of step back. I was discussing this with both of you before the podcast. My perception of retention is a spaghetti monster within GDPR, which is in its own right a spaghetti monster. And that retention is a core element to being compliant with data protection. You have to have an idea of how the data will be effectively destroyed or anonymized or archived or whatever. And as a result, it becomes, in my opinion, and what I've seen across this industry, it's something that just isn't taking that seriously. So the first thing when I'm looking at it is, any kind of process that you're doing with data protection, you know, you're thinking about your OPA, you're thinking about your privacy notes, you're thinking about your lawful basis. And really that should be tagged along that is, okay, well, once that process has been completed, what do we do then? How is the data destroyed? What is our regulations? What's our responsibility? And how do we demonstrate it? So that's my kind of like holistic approach to it. And it from kind of like a top level viewpoint of it, and you'd have like your policies to kind of implement that. So you're going to have your retention policy and schedule, you're probably going to have your records management policy kind of working alongside it, possibly some other kind of classification policies, which I'll probably talk about a little bit more in a moment. But right now I think that's it for me holistically. And if you are doing like your DPIAs, the amount of times that, you know, you'll say, how long are you going to hold this data for? And you just put, see it, retention policy. You're thinking, well, you know, okay, that's fantastic, but actually you should say how long you're holding the data for, what data, you know, for what legal obligation, but the more importantly, what is the termination of that? Is that destroyed? Is that archived? And then how is that destroyed? You know, is it in paper format? Is that then data sent to like a I can't remember what it's called. Is it shredded? Is there like a waste bin? If it's digital, do you get a company to come in and audit it? Or if it is like stored on like a hard disk drive, storage device, you know, and these are the questions I think by the time you've kind of gone through the whole process of doing your GDPR compliance, your due diligence. So my interpretation is people just don't care at this point. They're just like, just get rid of it.
I think with retention, it can be such a headache when, you know, you need to do it. You need to implement measures retrospectively that, it tends to be avoided once it's got to that stage. It's really hard to implement, you know, when, first of all, you've got to take a step back and look at what you're storing, where you're storing it, and how you are, and get that in order. Make sure that things are being, you know, stored where they should be, that you've got proper processes in place for that before you even consider the next step of deletion. But I feel when it comes to retention, there's two elements to it, and you know, it both might be neglected. But one of them definitely is. So there's the policy side, the schedule side, establishing what those retention periods are, which can be tricky. You know, it can be a long process. There is guidance out there that you can use. But then the second part is actually enforcing those retention periods. And that is the part where, you know, it's a different story, basically. That spaghetti monster that you're talking about.
Leslie has said that retention is difficult where our systems do not enable this. And yes, I completely agree.
Yeah.
Realistically, if you are implementing a new system, you know, you should be, as data practitioners, you should be asking what rights are applicable and how are you going to enable them? So like subject access request, rectification, that kind of stuff. The big one's going to be your erasure. And realistically, that mirrors the retention. So you need to establish in a new system, how will they destroy the data? And the amount of agreements I've seen where they don't actually list that as a function, or when I've communicated with a client and the response back is that the processor, they could add that on as a feature. And I'm thinking that should be a mandatory feature straight off the bat. I think the biggest problem with what you've said about systems where they don't do this is historical systems. And where I've spoken to someone and they've got a system, it was the latest system 10 years ago, but then like a key function of deleting data just isn't there. And, you know, at that point is, well, how do you manage the retention if the system can't physically delete it? The way that I've kind of gone about it is then communicating with the system owner. So if it is an in-house system, it's talking about, you know, to the people, to the developers who can maintain it, seeing if there's a feature that you can implement there. But more often than not, typically it's contracted out. It's like a software as a system, a service or something like that. And it's communicating with them and trying to figure out, well, actually, we need to get this retention in place, and really trying to emphasize that it's a legal requirement that we can manage and control the data in this context. And I definitely think that is by far one of the biggest problems when talking about retention. I think a lot of people get scared around it as well, because they kind of know, oh, we shouldn't really be holding on to this data for 10-20 years.
Yeah, exactly. I think as well, you need to strip it back and, you know, take it to an operational individual level and ensure that everybody's trained on how to use the systems appropriately. You know, things like that, because in some organizations, it just, everyone has their own way of working. It's not a standardized approach. It makes things so much more difficult to manage. It makes, you know, not just retention when it comes to breaches and things like that, you know, that it's vital. And then once you go past that level, you need to look at, I reckon, information asset owners or process owners, whatever you like to call them, and make sure that in each area, business area or business function, there's somebody with oversight over how those, you know, what process and activities are occurring and, you know, and managing those as well.
Yeah, Sam's actually highlighted in the chat that people are scared of deleting data as well, just in case. Well, the ICO are quite strong on the fact that you should not retain data just in case. If you don't need it, you should delete it. So if it's not essential to what you're doing in terms of your processing activities, then that data, you know, you don't need it, so you should delete it. And working on the support desk, I come across quite a lot of retention queries, and people are often asking, you know, how long should we retain said data? And sometimes it can be, you know, retention periods write themselves, in terms of, if you're employing someone, then, you know, you're going to keep hold of that data until the end of the employment, and then plus 6 years. Whereas some retention periods can be quite tricky to navigate. I had an example yesterday. I was on a call with a customer of ours, and they were they collect photos and images of their staff through meetings, and they place it on their website. And they were asking me, so how long should we retain that information? And to be honest with you, I didn't quite know the answer. And I guess it's up until the website's no longer in use, because, I mean, how do you justify how long you're going to need an image of something for the purpose of placing it on your website for a news article? Because you can't keep data forever, so you need to set some sort of retention period. I don't know if you two are able to provide a bit more of an answer on that. Maybe, do you have an inclination of how long you think you should keep that for?
Tristan, I was reading the chat.
I was reading the chat. The chat was absolutely popping off. So yes, it's a really, really tricky one, because it also depends on, realistically, if you've got this picture on a website, what base are you taking those pictures? Are you using legitimate interest or consent? So you kind of open up Pandora's box, like anything data protection, the spaghetti monster's coming out, because I don't want to say it depends, but the circumstances are so important. I wouldn't have a blanket approach, that's straight off, you know, saying, you know, for how long the website is, you're kind of bundling up a lot of different processes in one area. And I think what you need to do, in my opinion, would be to kind of break down the processes onto an individual basis and looking at it and really trying to do a data lifecycle and really figuring out what the journey for the data is, what is your lawful basis, and really trying to figure it out from that perspective. And looking at the different elements of kind of like consent and possibly the right to erasure. I know the right to erasure isn't necessarily guaranteed with consent, but the right to withdraw consent is there. So it's a much more complicated and difficult element before you even kind of hit the point of retention. But then when you're hitting kind of the point of retention of how long you should be holding on for that data and really justifying the legal obligation, again, it's going to be coming down to the nitty gritty and ripping apart all the separate little mini processes and breaking it down. A good example of this is take you have an employee's, I don't know, you got a director there. Picture is on a website, cool, fantastic. And you might justify it for, you know, once their employment's been terminated, we'll hold on to this picture for, I don't know, one plus year, and after that, we'll destroy it. But then a picture of, say, I don't know, of an employee or an individual, you might take a picture of that and want to highlight their work or records or whatever they've done or some kind of achievement. That reasoning of why you're holding that, why you're taking that picture and holding that reason and holding that data for the duration is going to be different to the first point. So like all things data protection, it has to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, and you got to sit down and kind of unpick it, all of it. So hopefully that kind of answers your question, where it's kind of like, it's a difficult one without more information to provide.
Yeah, no, that was good.
There's a lot going on in the chat about email retention. I think this is one of the biggest difficulties that organizations face, because especially when it comes from the top down in an organization where, you know, say, emails are retained, you know, just in case for long periods of time, where obviously that's not the best approach. But when emails or important emails don't leave, you know, the inbox or whatnot, then it is a risk, isn't it? So I had a look, I was just doing some digging yesterday, and I found National Archives guidance on email retention, which is quite useful, to be fair. So it set out that you'll need to define clearly which emails need to be kept for business or historical value, communicate simply and often to users the rules for what emails to keep, and keep emails with related digital information in a shared corporate information management system. So that's similar to what we do. We use Salesforce and we log relevant emails against the system where we need to keep a record of such. And, you know, for us, we've got a year retention period? I think so.
I don't know.
Yeah. Which, to be honest, I've never really had an issue with. I remember, you know, when I was aware of that, thinking, oh, what if, as everyone does, what if I need something from 13 months ago? And it's very rare that that's the case. And if it is the case, it's simply something internal that someone else will have anyway, that I probably should have saved. but yeah, so I'll put the link to this in the chat so everyone can have a little look at it.
Yeah.
But it also talks about the risks around using email archiving systems as well. So while potentially useful for backup purposes in short to midterm, the use of email archiving systems presents some risks in terms of information management, such as loss of contextual information when emails are bundled into large compressed files, difficulty in determining which emails are of value and which can be disposed of due to loss of context, inaccurate or inadequate search returns due to large volumes of emails, over or under restriction on access due to limited access controls, and inability to implement disposal due to limited disposal functionality as well. So it's really interesting. I recommend the read. You know, it relates to the National Archives and public bodies and whatnot, but it can be applied across all many organizations. So
absolutely, yeah. And touching on that sort of stuff, that sort of guidance, there's quite a lot out there, isn't there, for retention in terms of guidance across multiple sectors. I mean, we yeah. work predominantly in social housing, so, you know, we're very aware of the National Housing Federation retention schedule that, you know, we often go to when customers are coming to us and asking for guidance on retention. And Jasmine, me and you did some digging, didn't we? And we came across quite a lot of the stuff. And I think it is worth pointing out that although this, that, you know, this is there and it's good and it's guidance, that is what it is at the end of the day. So if you want to keep things for shorter or for longer periods of time, it's completely up to you, as long as you can justify the reasons for doing so. So at the end of the day, you know, it's good to follow loosely to an extent, but ultimately it is your decision how long you keep hold of your data.
Yeah, I think it's useful where, you know, there's legal obligations for certain types of information. You know, it just makes life a lot easier in that sense. But even some of the guidance, you know, looking at the National Housing Federation's guidance, then that, to me, some of that can be challenged. I think I remember a year ago or something like that, looking at the National Housing Federation's guidance on CCTV, it being like 31 days or something. And when you actually ask, well, why is that necessary? Why not 2 weeks? You know, if there's an issue with, you know, an ASB case or theft or crime or whatever it is 2 weeks not enough? If not, you know, or where is it pointing? What's the purpose for the CCTV? you know, is 31 days excessive, things like
that. Yeah, but don't forget, you're questioning something that's guidance, not something that's, you know, they're not saying that it has to be 31 days. They're just kind of, are you saying that they should put in there as 14 days as guidance, and then if an organization wants to keep longer for 30 days, then, you know, they can, as long as they justify it?
Not necessarily. I'm just saying context is important. So, you know, you don't want to just look at this guidance and say, okay, that's what they've said, we'll go with that. You need to question whether it applies to your organization. Just reiterating what you're saying, really, Joe. And understanding whether, you know, it applies in the same way. So, for example, you know, you use CCTV for making sure staff aren't sleeping on the lunch break or something, I don't know, then you wouldn't need that for 31 days afterwards. And, you know, it's just questioning things using a critical eye to make sure that it actually applies, and that if you were to get questioned on it, you've got a valid reason, and rather than the fact that, oh, that's what they said, you know.
So Esther, a little bit before, maybe like 5 minutes ago, actually said about achieving Article 25 data privacy by design. And that's kind of what we're softly saying, is that everything that we're doing and how we are using and holding data, it's all about that, that ensuring that we embed like a privacy by design culture, that we are processing data on a strictly necessity, purpose limitation. I'm just kind of going through the principles of GDPR at this point, but it's ensuring that we are being as efficient and as effective as possible. And going through, what's really interesting in the chat is everyone kind of stating different years of how long they're holding emails for. You know, I think some people said 6 months, some people said 2 years, 6 years, which is kind of really fascinating how it is so kind of broad and wide, and it does come down to that kind of justification. For me, one thing that makes it even more complicated is that it depends on, again, context. You know, what are those emails being used for? If an email is being used to discuss, say, legal matters and it becomes legally privileged, that's going to have a different retention to, say, me emailing Joe saying, hi, Joe, hope you're doing well. And it becomes even more and more kind of complicated depending on how granular you want to go. And it creates, if you go very granular, it creates a massive burden on the staff and the people who are responsible for kind of maintaining the retention period.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just so much going on in the chat, which is fantastic.
I know. That's made a really good point, actually. So there's a lot of focus in online marketing regarding scope 3 emissions currently, and businesses looking to minimize carbon footprint. Has anyone got any stats about how much carbon an email takes up to store? When I was doing some preparation for this podcast, I found some risks. Hold on. Not even risks, just, you know, things that you need to consider about when you're just taking retention seriously, really, you know, the effect that it might have on SARS, on breaches, on, you know, storage and costs around that. And I think that ties in with that quite nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen something in the chat that's made me go and do some research and I can't find it. It's about, it's Rachel saying that, how, out of curiosity, how long are people, are people's organisations holding hold of records of breaches? It's a very good question, actually, and I've just done a little bit of digging in the National Housing Federation schedule, and it says 6 years, but again, should be taken on a case-by-case basis. You know, if it's a major personal data breach and the ICO are conducting an investigation, and it's, you know, we're all aware that the ICO can be quite slow, you know, you might be able to justify keeping hold of a record of breaches for a little bit longer than 6 years. So I think I'd take that one on a case-by-case basis, depending on the type of breach and what's going on, really. I don't know if you two have any different opinions to that.
I kind of completely agree with what you're saying, Joe. It's going to be really down to that kind of case-by-case basis. When I used to work for a charity, we would have legacy cases, and we had the legal right to archive this data, because, you know, these cases could reopen up and we'd have to pull up the data again. So, you know, it really does come down to a case-by-case basis, especially if you are potentially being investigated by regulatory the ICO, effectively. Can't think what the word is called, but you get what I'm saying. And it's so true, though. It really does come down to kind of a granular approach, and really what the appetite of the organization is as well. How seriously does an organization take their retention? I know some have adopted, you know, we don't we we need to keep hold of as much data as possible, as they just in case. There are some that have a very, shall we say, reserved for data when it's anything to do about legal matters, and others, you know, if it's over and done with, you know, we should get rid of it. So it really is kind of a case by case basis, and it really boils down to that justification and documenting that justification so you can demonstrate it if it is ever challenged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's a question then. If you've you're doing some processing and you've got to retain some personal data, and it's on a case by case basis, and there could be multiple different retention periods depending on, you know, what's actually going on, how do you apply that into your retention schedule?
That's a very, very good question. So it depends on how you kind of classify them. If you're going to say classify, let's say you've got like a legal case regarding personal identifiable information, and it's about someone challenging your organization to go to court, you know, you're going to be looking at really that legally privileged information. So you're going to be holding that for much longer. It's going to fall into the category of like your kind of legal classification. Whereas let's say it was, I don't know, someone shared the information, really minor, minimal data breach, it will probably fall into like a kind of a different classification. It will probably still fall under like legal, but then in a different, I'm thinking of this kind of in like a ROPA way as well as a retention way. So I'm trying to like think about it. Again, it depends on the appetite of the organization, how they want to define it. But I think having a layered approach and kind of ranking how, whether you have a data breach and how severe it is, will kind of come into play of that.
Yeah, no. Absolutely. There's another live example in the chat about subject access requests. And again, the National Housing Federation say that they got from the ICO's website that a minimum retention period for subject access requests is 6 years, but a recommended retention period would be 1 year for that one. Just for those that are discussing that in the chat.
I'm interested in that. 6 years?
No, 6 months as a minimum.
Oh, right.
And I then thought... 1 year as okay. a standard.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, to be fair. I think as well with that, you can justify the fact that, you know, SARS can bring costs to businesses. We see it obviously firsthand. So if an individual is to put in, you know, a second request on the same information, at least you've got that there. Obviously, if they get to challenge the subject access request, you've got, you know, the evidence for whatever that might be as well. So, but sorry to put you on the spot, Michael. You don't have to unmute if you don't want to. But what is the justification for 3 or 6 years for retaining SARS, if you wouldn't mind answering?
I think it was just like a standard default that some of us put in place. I mean, there's a lot of us using the NHS code of retention. Sorry, I'm not going to quote it on that document's name. It's been a while. But I think a lot of us have considered it. It's not something my business is doing. I'm looking to revamp and update our current retention for things. But some people did 6 years and then they said, actually, maybe we just don't have anything going that far back. They're just very, very poor records. So I've helped a number of organizations brush theirs up. So you probably argue there's probably more issues, but I think if you have a summary of every type of SAR and it goes beyond the 6 years or 3 years, just for learning purposes, just to give a rough scope of what you did or what you sent out, instead of all the records and information that was sent to the data subject, that's really good, because then you can say, well, we've learned, we've kept a record of like deletion, which everybody has to have anyway, and a summary of what we've done. But we haven't kept everything because the storage and cost to hide it is too much. Then you could probably get away with even having a shorter time period. But, you know, you will get one guy. And we had one guy, he responded after 15 years and he said he wanted one he sent in. And we had to be honest, it wasn't there. But there was like no reference to him anywhere at all, because it just wasn't something we were following at the time. And also the paperwork, I think, was completely black with mold. So I didn't want to send that to him. And we had one lady who made a request about a tower that was built 100 years ago, which was also completely black with mold. So it had one word that was visible. It said cement, but that doesn't mean it could be that the wall was made of cement, the roof was made of cement.
Well, the paper's covered in it.
Yeah, so you get a victim of your lack of knowledge or records then, and then you can kind of you know, that's when people use retention. But I mean, let's just think about it. Let's make the next generation have a better record of things, and that's the most important thing. You don't need the 10,000 emails that you had to redact, prepare 6 years ago, because that's going to be too onerous to put together and send it in storage wise. And then you don't know the mindset of the person who completed it. They may not have, actually, they may have missed one email in that group, but how do you know which one it was? That's a lot of work. So yeah, but it's how nice you want to be.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. So I think one way to, I guess, tackle the data that you hold, not just retention per se, but obviously as a next step, is maybe to have some sort of classification of information. I think this probably applies more to larger organizations than smaller ones. Just, you know, by nature, it might be difficult to oversee, but what are your thoughts on that?
I got that information classification policy. I know, right? To be fair, I kind of want to take a bit of a backdrop of what Michael's just said, because really, I think it comes down to this with retention. It's all about your records management. Your records management policy, how efficient and how effective have you made your environment? And to kind of say like a best case or best practice scenario, I think you want your retention to become a self-cleaning oven. So it's constantly kind of like data that you don't need is being deleted, and that therefore you kind of free up your storage and whatnot. So a way to do this is what I did in my old previous employment, and I've got a friend who's just been kind of doing it for another organization, is looking at, you know, implementing like an information classification policy, and on the backdrop of that, a retention kind of policy, not a retention labeling system. So one thing that I used to do in my previous employment is information wasn't really classified. We didn't know what was public, what was internal, what was confidential or private. So what we would do is we created a policy to kind of able to label and categorize our information. And by doing that, it actually helped us from a GDPR perspective, because we could work out what anything that was kind of confidential was going to be personal data. So we could kind of start to kind of scope out and make sure that that data was more protected, and we could effectively achieve Article 25 privacy by design default. And as a result, we can actually look at enforcing effective retention labels. What we would do with the retention labels is effectively any kind of piece of information, including emails, you could effectively mark up and say, right, well, this retention is going to be 7 years, 6 years, and then from that point, within the 6 years, it will delete itself. By automating it, you actually create, as I said, like this self-cleaning oven, and you actually are able to kind of get on top and manage your infrastructure much more effective. Sounds fantastic on paper. In practical sense, it's really difficult to get involved. I've seen a few comments in the chat about how do you get, you know, like your CEO, your executive involved, or why should they care? And doing a process where you start to classify and effectively automate deletion is very challenging because, you know, it does come down to that kind of just, you know, once we need this, once we do this. And I think it's about really following kind of the policies and the automation, then doing a really effective training and kind of demonstrating, look, this is why we need to hold on to this, and these are the overarching benefits, not just retention. As I said, you can put in better cybersecurity controls, you can put in much better tools to manage your subject access requests and personal data, and also there are genuinely going to be cost saving benefits, because you are going to save a lot of storage space, especially if you are doing things locally, if you're having your own kind of servers and networks and whatnot. So the system that you used, for anyone who wants to know, was Microsoft Purview, which we're finding, well, I've used in the past, and I find it to be quite a really effective tool. There, see, someone's, David has just said the same thing. Thank you. But it is very cheap. The only problem with Purview is that to do the more advanced stuff, because you can actually do ROPAs and whatnot, you need to have more certifications, more qualifications through Microsoft, and it does become a little bit more expensive in terms of having a developer for that. But yeah, that's a like a real kind of like snippet of like information classification, data retention, data retention labels, and creating effectively a self-cleaning service. Someone did ask about Tristan, did people have to manually classify, or did you have something in place to automatically classify based on policies? I believe you can do it automatically. But going back to this idea of you having information asset owners, what we did was we nominated data champions. And by having like kind of these people who were nominated, it was their part of their responsibility to kind of classify or to train up the teams to ensure that it was classification. So it is kind of a two-pronged approach. You have the actual systems and policy, but then you need to have really robust and effective training. And it also needs to be... three-pronged approach. You need to have a culture and an environment where it is proactively wanting to enforce effectively data hygiene. It's not just about being GDPR compliant. You can really scope this out and looking at it from just an information asset owning information and being as clean and as cleansed with your information as possible. I hope that helps.
I think alongside that as well, it highlights the importance for ensuring or embedding data protection impact assessments into, you know, your process, into your organizational procedures, where, you know, a DPA might be for high risk processing. I think it's best practice to do them on systems as well, to make sure that systems can effectively facilitate, you know, all of your responsibilities under data protection law, whether that's rights, whether that's retention. It makes you ask the question from the start, really.
It does. And on top of like a retention, any kind of classification, you can embed that into your DPIA process. So not only do you have the information asset owner stating how long it should be, the DPO should be then able to kind of either provide guidance or support that decision. And if it is, let's say, like a big system, maybe you want to then get other people involved, maybe executive and whatnot, so that they have their eyes and ears on it also. So there are multiple ways where if you have this really effective, like privacy by design and default, retention becomes somewhat easy, but it's all about embedding it into the processes and procedures. And I think kind of going back to what I originally said way at the beginning, retention just isn't taken seriously. And by making it serious, you can effectively create this really robust and much more manageable way.
Yeah, absolutely. I just had a thought, but it's escaped my mind.
Well, while you're trying to think, we've spoken quite heavily, haven't we, around retention and, you know, how long to keep data for and you know, what's the best way to do that. But what about actually disposing of personal data appropriately? I mean, as you mentioned earlier, Jasmine, I think it was yourself, you can use data cleansers and confidential waste bins. Actually, it might have been Tristan coming back to me now. Is there any other methods that organisations can dispose of data appropriately? Not to put you both on the spot.
Well, that's exactly what you did.
Do you want to take this one, Jasmine, or shall I?
I'll jump in if you want to take this one. I'll have a little think.
No worries. So, yes. So, you've got to ask yourself what that data is. So, the way that I see it, there's two kind of soft three variations of how information can be. You've got your digital, so your emails, your like project work, stuff on servers and whatnot. You have your more physical, sort of handwritten notes. And then you kind of have this hybrid of the two, which is more physical, but like storage devices, in my previous employment, when a laptop was basically obsolete, the big question was, well, how do we delete the data? And so effectively, it's all about managing your kind of e-waste. So how would you handle that? There are certain companies that you can hire that can do this for you. And I'm trying to remember what the qualification is, and I can't remember off the top of my head. That's a national, you should ensure that they are part of the National Association for Information Destruction, and they have these kind of credentials. So you know that they are effectively certified to destroy the said data, especially anything around sensitive data that's on like kind of storage devices, pen drives, that kind of stuff. Where it becomes a bit more tricky around getting a company or actually destroying the data, that in its own right is a GDPR process. So you're going to have to go through the GDPR kind of loopholes that you would normally have to do for any other kind of process. And as a result, when you are, if you're giving personal data or even just standard information, and you're not 100% sure that what is on there, so there could be special category data, there could be corporate sensitive information, it needs to be treated as such, and you've got to make sure you do need due diligence and that you've got a really effective DPA process in place, data processing activities in effect to ensure that that data is also protected. Another thing that you might want to also take into consideration is that there's an ISO standard called, I think it's 14001, that is the environmental standard to, you know, if you want to be green, which I think people should, making sure that they would dispose of the information in kind of like an ethically clean way. So that's another way of kind of handling data. Another form of destruction is kind of archiving it, redacting it, anonymizing it. But again, that's going to have to come under certain different categories. I'm just going to say again, in previous employment, we did a lot of research. We would have to make that research very public and archive it, and effectively would have to kind of go through the anonymization through that, redacting all kind of information or any personal identifiable information.
Mm-hmm. One thing as well I'd just like to add to that is to be cautious of any backup systems that are storing data as well. You need to make sure that you're applying retention periods to those as well, or it the data can't be restored essentially if it is supposed to be deleted or disposed of.
Yes. And another tool on top of that to kind of go with the backup is you can use certain software to make sure that systems are completely clean and destroyed and deleted. And ideally, you'd want to have a certification of destruction to go alongside that. But again, it's about making sure you're trusting and you're doing your due diligence on these softwares and processes to make sure that they actually do what you say. My only other final option you could do, and I've known no one to do this because it is too costly, is to audit a company, to pay someone to audit them to see if they have the data. But again, that is incredibly costly, and that requires a lot of different agreements as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, while we're on the topic of getting rid of data, we actually had a query come into the support desk. It's relevant, just believe me. They reported a personal data breach, and the breach was that the customer was deleting the data or getting rid of physical copies of data. Rather than put it into a confidential waste bin, it was just going into recycling. Now, this came into the support desk, and me and Kane had a bit of a debate, and my initial instinct was that it wasn't reportable, simply because it was, still getting destroyed, just not in the way they probably expected. Recycling companies aren't going to go digging through, or they're unlikely to be digging through any sort of copies of paper or anything to have a look if there's anything in there to cause harm to said data subjects. But then I kind of thought to myself, is it even a personal data breach? Kane, who, a member of our support desk, he said it was because the data was lost because it didn't go where it was meant to. But I didn't think it was lost because you still knew where it went. It just happened to be in the wrong place. So I'm interested to get your opinion, simply because if, some of our customers or people in this chat are putting things where they're not meant to, for examples, personal data, they put it in the wrong bin. Is that, does that class as a personal data breach?
I would say potentially yes, because it's essentially been disclosed to an external party who it wasn't intended to be disclosed to. Even though it's not necessarily disclosed, it's they could access it. So
I think it's a breach of security, but I don't think it's led to the unauthorized disclosure of or access to, but they've not accessed it because it's going into a bin.
Yeah, but
they're not going to go into the back of the bin, are they? They're not going to dig through.
Well, I mean, it's possible, but it's just very low level, I'd say. It's very unlikely that would amount to any risk, really. But at the end of the day, it meets the definition, in my opinion.
Kristen, you got the deciding vote.
Oh, no. I think from a purely statutory perspective, where we're looking at the examination of the law and, that element of it could potentially lead to a data breach, yes. However, the other question is what policies and procedures are in place? And it's going to be the question is who has access to that information as well. So going back to it, I have it depends on the organization's approach to information. So if it's only employees that can have access to this information, And the approach is that any employee can kind of pull up any kind of data. They're all working together. They're all working with kind of like a harmony, and that's the approach, and that is kind of codified. It might not be. However, if, let's say, other people can have access to it beyond the organization, that's when things become a lot more tricky, because at that point, well, yes, technically there is the potential of it having any unauthorized access. And if you follow the approach of the kind of zero architect of that, if there is potential breach, there could be a breach. So it is, it really is kind of tricky. I think for the point of erring on the side of caution, I would treat it as a breach. But again, there's a lot more context that we are required to really be able to define it as that.
Yeah, see, George has said that somebody who takes the waste out might read the data. But so we use a company called Shreddit, and we post all our confidential thing in there, as far as I'm aware. And, you know, some gentleman comes every month or whatever and comes and collects it. So in theory, is that a breach every time just because T comes and collects it and takes it off to shred it to delete?
See,
bit of a rhetorical question.
It is. But then it kind of comes back down to this element of, well, we'll have agreements in place. I guess you could argue, you know, do we check the person's the right person to take the data? You know, but this is why whenever you do a breach and anything that comes through, it's like always ask for the granular detail, because that is going to be your defining aspect and element. It is. Everyone's just kind of keeps lots of comments about this.
Oh, it doesn't get shredded before when it goes in the bin. I think they take it off, don't they, and shred it. It's just it's a bin that we can't access as members of staff. And the gentleman comes and just takes a bag of all our stuff, and then I think they shred it themselves. So it's not actually shredded in the office, as far as I'm aware.
No. As far as I'm aware.
There's no noise.
Everyone is kind of saying that, you know, yes, we'd have a DPA in place, we'd have our due diligence. You're, again, really completely correct. I mean, but then what happens if that company then went rogue? It's a risk that is involved, and it's important, and if you're doing a DPA, to highlight said risk and really look, like I said, the granular information, and really trying to kind of unpick it all and really trying to kind of get that like nitty gritty information to really determine it. Because at the end of the day, you know, a breach should be quite serious, and it should have that level of investigation that is required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry if that was a little bit off topic. I was trying to be a little bit of devil's advocate and kind of bring a real life, example of how easy it can be for someone to, you know, just put some personal data into the wrong sort of bin to get rid of the data, and how it can have consequences such as a personal data breach. So thanks for bearing with me on that one.
It's nearly the end of the session, but as some closing thoughts, I'd like to just stress, you know, the importance of how the principles under the GDPR cooperate, and, you know, the importance of, say, data minimization when it comes to retention, to limit how much information you actually are storing, the accuracy of that data, you know, that you've not got duplicates and things like that, to really help maintain and manage your information, on record, the security controls around it as well, making sure that, you know, it's limited access to certain areas, to certain people, or that as an organizational measure, you know, data is stored where it should be, etc. It all ties in, so it's really important to consider them all in conjunction with each other. I don't know if you've got any closing thoughts.
No, I think you've wrapped it up pretty nicely.
Yeah, it's all right. Spaghetti monster. But yeah, no, I kind of completely agree. I think there's so many comments and questions that we've not even been able to get to. So I think, is it fair to say, if you've got any comments or questions, please email them to Miles and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for attending. Thank you for your contributions. It's been a really busy session, one of the busiest we've had in a long time. So, and if you've got any any recommendations on what you'd like us to discuss on a podcast, just email us at info@dataprotectionpeople.com or email Miles, either way, and we'll see what we can do. But thank you, everyone, and have a great weekend. We will be back next week. Well, not me, but Joe. And
I'm not. I'm off.
Oh, well, Tristan.
Wait, what?
You're nominated. And whoever you decide to recruit will be back for a GDPR radio session.
The returning Phil Brining.
Oh, of course. Oh God, I'd love to see you two get away.
So we don't want to miss the returning tanned Phil Bryan. Yeah. He's had 2 weeks off, so
excitable.
He's got lots of stuff to talk about, I'm sure.
The excitable puppy returns. But yeah, thank you everyone. Have a great weekend and take it easy.
Thanks everyone.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.
Bye-bye.